Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network. And you could also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. So today we have a little bit different. This is not really an interview, more like a debate with Todd Lewis. He's a Christian philosopher. He's worked with Keith Preston, who's an anarchist, on his attackthesystem.com website. He's wrote a few articles there. Criticizing his just pointing out, I guess, some points of contention. He's had a few podcast episodes with Keith Preston as well. So we're going to debate. So I will be debating the voluntarist anarchist position, and he will be debating what he calls mere Christianity or distributism. And he'll describe a little more what that's about. Like any debate, I like to make sure we both understand the logical fallacies, and we'll have the logical fallacy website in the description to the video. So anybody who wants to learn more about those, basically errors in logic and reason, in order to keep a debate understandable and comprehensible by most people. So we'll be talking about some moral and philosophical inconsistencies on both sides, and we're gonna see where it goes. So Todd, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think you commented under my John Zimmerman debate video.
Yes.
And you enjoyed that, so you expressed interest to have a debate, and I'd like to debate more people, but amazingly enough, most people declined, especially people on Facebook who mm-hmm. like to comment and criticize my posts, and almost to troll type level. And mm-hmm. and I'm like, all right, well, if you love to argue so much, let's have a debate, basically face to face, but live. I think we can get more ideas across in a debate than, typing on Facebook comments, which is very tedious and, slow. And most people decline that. It's really amazing how most people don't take mm-hmm. me up on that offer.
Yeah, I've had problems with that too. People just don't want to hash it out,
Right, yeah, so, I don't know what that's about. So, yeah, thanks a lot for accepting. It's nice to exchange points of view and present mm-hmm. present your case to the listeners, and then let them make their own decisions. So can you, I guess, just state your case, and what is, when you say mere Christianity and distributism, what you see as those things?
Okay, so mere Christianity comes from the title of C.S. Lewis's book called Mere Christianity, where he discusses what he would consider the minimum acceptable beliefs that all Christians would hold. So, right, well, personally, I think he was an Anglican. He wasn't writing the book to defend Anglican Christianity or attack Roman Catholic or, Lutheran Christianity, but it is, in a sense, to define, broadly speaking, what would the minimum requirements be. So, right, in mere Christianity, the virgin birth, the resurrection of Christ would be, all Christians would accept that, right? Prohibitions against incest, murder, adultery, lying, stealing, all of those things would fall under the rubric of mere Christianity. Generally, I guess you could say mere Christianity would also line up rather well with the former moral majority of the 80s and 90s, since it reached across denominational lines. It included both Protestants, Catholics, to a lesser extent Orthodox, but there weren't very many of them in the country at that time. So that would be mere Christianity. I mean, I won't limit myself completely to that, but I'll try to be general in that regard. Like, what would the Christian tradition say about these issues? Looking at it as a whole, mm-hmm. whether I agree with everything in that tradition is different, but as a whole, I think it's a useful guiding principle. Now, distributism is economic theory, which states that property is best when widely distributed. And that comes from Aristotle. Aristotle says that he argues for private property because it's moral. Private property allows people to develop responsibility, and more importantly, one of the virtues which he calls magnanimity, which is allowing you to give properly at the right time to the right people. And of course, if you don't have anything to give, then of course that virtue cannot even be developed. Similarly, Paul echoes that in his epistles, where he says that let a man not steal so that he can work and then give to the poor. So we see, well, charity is not the same as magnanimity. Both Aristotle and Paul argue that you have to have property to then develop a surplus so you can expend it in a way that habituates you to virtuous lifestyle. And the other argument, the reason why widely distributed property is advocated, is that it is one of the preconditions for freedom. C.S. Lewis argues that the only man who can be truly free is a man who eats his own mutton on his own table, raised on his own land. Because if the government owns the land or a large corporation owns the land and he has to be employed by them, to some extent his conscience is captive to his job. If they decide to fire him, he might not say certain things. Whereas a man who owns the land that he lives on and works the land that he lives on is free to speak his conscience without fear of usually a business reprisal, but not necessarily always that. So that would be a very brief introduction to those two positions.
So what would you say the difference is between distributism, when you say Aristotle says that private property must be distributed, so the difference between distributism and socialism? Are they synonymous?
Yeah. No. See, I would consider distributism a form of... We might disagree on the term capitalism, but I think that any system that's based on the ownership of private property is a species of capitalism, though they're not all the same. I mean, crony capitalism isn't the same as laissez-faire capitalism, but both are based on private ownership. Distributism is also based on private ownership. Aristotle argued that property in general let's go back to the root word of economy. Where does economy come from? It comes from the Greek word oikos nomos, which means household law. And the idea was that the economy was the study of the means by which a family could sustain itself by producing the necessary goods for survival. Minimally speaking, of course, surpluses were produced, and that could then be traded and bought and sold. And the idea was that the arrangement of property should be at the level of the family, because that's where the society itself is grounded. So, right, there's one of three ways you could distribute property. It could be collectively owned, like in a social society or a communal society. It could be completely privately owned in the sense of individuals owning property, like in a laissez-faire libertarian voluntary society. Or the locus could be at the level of the family, it's greater than the individual, but less than the collective over the state. And Aristotle, the Christian tradition, and distributism in general would argue that the fundamental building block of a society is the family. The family, you start there and then you build up. Because as Aristotle said, man cannot survive as a lone individual, otherwise he'd be a god or an animal. And the first and most oldest and natural means of humans coming together to better serve their physical needs is a family. And then from there, other forms of social systems derive. And so private property would be considered, again, one of the best examples of distributism in practice, though sadly most distributists don't use it, is the account we see in the Old Testament, specifically with Joshua, where he divides the land amongst the tribes of Israel. And how Israel, the different tribes are given plots of land within those tribes, certain families are given plots of land according to the needs of the family, where a smaller family would need less land to live than a larger family. So a larger family would be allocated a larger plot of land. So those would be some of the rationales for distributism.
So the way I describe the economy to most people is basically, I guess, a very similar definition to voluntarism, which is basically peaceful people engaging in voluntary interaction and exchange, right? Mm-hmm. That can be going all the way back to basic barter, exchanging items for items or services for services. And that has its associated limitations, which is what stimulated the invention of money. But when you do that, when two people voluntarily engage in exchange, the only reason they engage is because both people would benefit from it, right? So it's always a win-win, mm-hmm. right? Because if it's a win-lose, mm-hmm. then one person is coerced, and that would not be an economic exchange. That would be a crime or theft or, assault or rape mm-hmm. or something like that. So both people have to be willing, so both people benefit. So therefore, there's always an increase in the standard of living whenever people are free to engage in voluntary trade. So at the basic level, it's two people. And you can compound that as much as you want and make that into millions of people. And it's basically the same thing, people engaging in free and peaceful interaction, right? Now, that's completely divorced from the state. Any state mm-hmm. coercion, any, protectionism, mm-hmm. subsidies, any bailouts, no taxation, nothing like that. No coercion, no violence, right? Because once you introduce violence mm-hmm. into the equation, you're no longer talking about peaceful economic exchange. So that's the way I look at it. It's interesting what you said about the family, because I agree with that. That the family is very powerful. I think the closer people strengthen their familial bonds with each other, mm-hmm. and with your close friends and with your neighbors, I think the more the state can be rendered obsolete irrelevant, let's say, because mm-hmm. a lot of people who don't have that kind of familial support from their friends or family, they begin to use the state as a crutch, to lean on for survival, mm-hmm. as in food stamps, EBT cards, welfare, right, subsidized housing, mm-hmm. Medicare, Medicaid, and so the incentive becomes, once you have a welfare state, a growing massive welfare state, the incentive basically is to not treat your friends and family with kindness and respect, because who cares if they're not going to support you, because you always have the big daddy state coming in to or the nanny state coming in mm-hmm. to protect you and help you up and everything like that. So it kind of subsidizes immorality. Right.
Exactly.
Right. So.
In fact, that's the argument that Hans Hoppe makes in Democracy of the God That Failed, which I think has a very interesting book. He makes a lot of very interesting points. One of the points that Hoppe makes, of course, is the actual development of private property was developed in the context of families and inheritance. Right. So the family would be the unit in which property was disposed of. And of course, you then had to determine who would inherit it when you died. And that's another thing. In a society where childlessness or illegitimacy is normative, private property itself is an idea that has certain presuppositions, certain beliefs or structures that undergird it itself. You have to first have these things before you have private property.
Mm-hmm.
One of those things, of course, is the family, because if there's no inheritance, there's no next generation to pass the property on to next, then private property loses a lot of its meaning, because you're here today and gone tomorrow, and then you don't care what happens after.
Mm.
And then that's one of the arguments Hoppe makes in Democracy of the God That Failed. That's why he argued that kings were more likely to care about their land, their property, than a democracy was, because you're here today, gone tomorrow. It's not mine. It's not my friends or family that are going to take care of it. And, again, that's also why the Marxists, who directly attacked private property, attacked the three pillars of private property. They attacked the family, they attacked organized religion, and I would also argue they also attacked state structures. And they argue that all three of those undergird, to some level, private property. And they attacked all three, because they understood that if you attack the foundation of private property, it will collapse in on itself. There will be nothing to sustain it. It's like you have a building and you knock out the walls and the roof falls down because there's nothing holding it up.
Mm.
And family is one of those pillars. And so private property should be arranged in such a way that it strengthens the family, which in turn strengthens one of the fundamental pillars that undergirds the private property system. And that's why I think distributists argue for what they do, because they're saying we need to have a family-centric economy rather than an individualist or collectivist-centric economy.
So when you say a family-centered economy, like, so you said according to distributism, you know, property should be distributed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how would it be distributed? That's my question.
Yeah. Well, actually, first of all, I wrote an article on this on my blog, and okay. I'll link to it in the show notes later.
Okay.
But okay, fundamentally, there's quite a few ways in which you can do this, right? Assuming, you know, sort of Robinson Crusoe scenario, you could, if that's the general convention of property, then people would just naturally do that, right? So in a communist society, the natural assumption was that private property should be commonly owned, and they just did that. In a private property society, like in the United States, you don't necessarily need to enforce it because people automatically behave according to those principles, right? They just act that way because that's how they believe it should be. It's the way they understand things to be. It's right in a private property society, people aren't going to just say, oh, let's organize it according to common ownership of the means of production. Well, they wouldn't. They don't think that way. They wouldn't organize it that way. So now I think the question you're really asking is, we don't have that now. How do we get there in the future? Well, there's a few ways we could do that. One of the ways we could do it is this was done by the Russian state. This could be done by a private bank, but the example that I'm going to give you was in the late 19th, early 20th century, the Russian Empire realized that they needed a middle class. The 1905 revolution showed them that the gap between rich and poor was too great, and the communist radicals could use that as leverage in their revolution. So they went about creating a middle class by creating what they called the Peasants' Land Bank, which would the peasants would invest in the bank, and they would use that to buy up land from the boyars, the Russian nobles. Then they would then give that land back to the peasant communes. Of course, they would then divide it up amongst themselves. And by the end of, by 1914, 80% of European Russia, the land was in the percent of the hands of the peasants rather than the boyars. Now, again, you know, we wouldn't have to have a state to do that. We could have a private bank set up that would buy up property and then distribute it according to those principles. Another way you could do it, Taiwan did this in a similar way. What they did was, the land of the landlords in Thailand, they said basically, look, if you give us the land, we will give you shares in the new companies, the new tech companies that we're going to be creating. And so what they did was they were able to relatively peacefully transfer the land from the landlords to the people that worked them. They also had a system whereby the people that worked the land, it was kind of like a rent-to-own process where basically they were paying a sort of rent, but once they paid a certain amount, they would then own the land they worked on. And so they accomplished what was accomplished in mainland China. Well, sort of. Mainland China just had the state take over all the property. They accomplished what Mao claimed to want to accomplish, giving the land back to the people. And again, it was through compensation. It's like, look, you're going to get an equivalent value in shares in a company, and which will give you the controlling interest in the company. And then the people that work the land can then work a certain amount of time to pay the price of the land, and then they own it. And then a third way would be a sort of people that have gained land unjustly. For instance, the banking class that we see in the 2008 crisis through fraud was able to acquire a lot of land. You could just have legal suits against people that acquired land unjustly. And that land could then be divided amongst the victims of the fraud according to such principles. So these are possible ways by which you could distribute property in this way.
Okay.
And again, I had to use state examples because those are the ones that I have, but you could easily substitute those with private actors like banks or churches or concerned social groups like, you know, fraternities.
Mm-hmm. All right. I wanted to go back to what you said about private property in the United States, and you mentioned crony capitalism and laissez-faire capitalism. And I stopped using the term crony capitalism like months ago, maybe a year ago, because I saw one guy who said that calling what we have today as crony capitalism is calling rape crony lovemaking. right? So capitalism, maybe we should define capitalism, actually. This would probably be a good segue for that. Because, and I think we did a video before, which I'm going to put up. So the way I look at capitalism, and also actually I think this is the way it's defined in the dictionary, is basically the private ownership of, you know, I think it's the means of production, the factories of, you know, things like that, of businesses of, you know, entirely devoid of any state control, right? So no state, no state whatsoever. So they're basically defining anarchy, but they're not defining anarchy. So basically, yeah, private ownership, you know, no regulations, no minimum wage, no OSHA, nothing like that. So do you agree with that?
Definition? I agree with the dictionary definition, although I'm not sure the dictionary definition necessarily is as broad as you make it sound. It seems to me that any system
they don't mention OSHA and all that. I'm just putting that in. But yeah,
basically, but basically any system where private property is the normative means of ownership would be, I consider, a form, a species of capitalism. They're not all the same, obviously. I mean,
So what I was saying was that's the reason I stopped using crony capitalism, is because what we have today is such a mutant, perverted form of what true, like what I consider capitalism is free market capitalism, right? That's, to me, that's a fuller definition, a fuller descriptive word to describe it. And I think that illustrates it better. And so today, what we have today is what I would call more corporate fascism, right? Merger between the corporate entities and the state, right? And state power, you know, the state granting them the corporate shield, sovereign immunity, and legal protection from, you know, fraud and from, you know, any kind of wickedness that that they do, they're basically able to, you know, get given free passes that most people or most businesses are not. And then they turn around and they oftentimes pay off and bribe various politicians and get them to pass laws, right? Favorable preferential laws and favor that kind of thing. So that's kind of the way that I view that. And so laissez-faire capitalism is to me a synonymous term with anarchy, free market capitalism, that kind of stuff. So what would you say? You have any comments with that?
Well, not to belabor the point too much, but I wouldn't call what we have today fascism. I've heard it used a lot by the left and by libertarians, but it really shows an ignorance of what fascism is. When Mussolini said that fascism was the merger of corporate and state power, what do you mean by corporate power? What Mussolini means by corporate power is the idea that within the Italian nation, there's different industries, right? There's the fishing industry that might be composed of, say, different companies, but there is the fishing industry. So for him, a corporation is kind of like a guild. Each industry is organized and has a sort of representative body. So you have like the fishing industry, the lumber industry, the mining industry, and they would all be homogenized, and then they would have representation within the fascist system, and then they could work out their... It is a kind of collective bargaining where all the companies would be merged into one industry. And so we don't have that at all in the United States. What we have in the United States is very diversified corporations, and they're not organized like a guild system where you have this sort of like collective... Because the whole point of fascism, according to Mussolini, he wrote for the Encyclopedia Britannica back in like 1930-something, what is fascism? And basically, it's a species of socialism, and the argument is that he's for the empowerment of workers, just like socialists say they're for the empowerment of workers. And he argues that by creating these corporate guilds, that all the lumberjacks, all the fishermen, all the miners have a level of collective bargaining that they wouldn't otherwise have. But he also understands, unlike the socialists, that you can't have worker management. People don't have, you know, you have to have special technicians to run factories. And so they would select from within their guilds managers that would run those factories. I think what we have now is closer to mercantilism. You know, you think of like the East India Company,
or you
think of a lot of the early companies in America, like the Hudson Bay Company.
Mm-hmm.
you know, these were, now granted, our companies aren't state chartered because we have enough private capital. We don't need state chartered companies. But in a lot of ways, like mercantilism, we have this sort of like buddy-buddy system where these companies can work with the government, get special treatment from the government, and the government gets extra profits. So I think fascism is unhelpful because it's politically charged, because it's misunderstood, and certainly what we have is not fascism. It's closer to mercantilism, I would say. But even then, it's not quite the same thing either, because mercantilism believed that the goal of the economy was to have a surplus in trade and not a deficit in trade, and to hoard precious metals. Which, again, we don't do that either. We run a trade deficit, and we don't hoard precious metals. So it's not mercantilism either. But I think mercantilism, in a general sense, is probably closer to what we have. But that's more of a definitional disagreement.
Yeah, I think. I mean, the trajectory, especially, I'd say, has been much quickened since 1913, the creation of the Federal Reserve, I guess the centralization of state power, you know, the expansion of the federal government, the creation of all of these, you know, federal agencies, the, you know, vast increases in taxes, you know, especially the income tax, and of course the hidden tax of inflation as well. So the trajectory, the way I look at it is, because you know, looking at like talking about Karl Marx and his 10 planks of communism, many of those can be applied today, right?
Many of them are in place.
Yeah, many of them are in place, right? You know, you have, you know, the public education system. You got, you know, the Federal Reserve, right? Monopoly on money. You got
organized labor.
Monopolies on transportation. You know, on on roads. You know, highways, things like that. So a lot of those things are already in place. So it really seems like, I mean, communism, I guess, would be the end goal. that'd be signified collapse to me, complete totalitarian collapse.
I think what you'd say is according to Marx, we're in the stage of socialism. Socialism is that state where right before you get to communism, where you're in this transitional phase.
Right.
So yeah. maybe socialism is a better word for what we have now.
Regardless, it's not good.
It's not good. Regardless.
The way I look at it, you know, talking about, you know, this election, because everyone's always asking, what do you think about the candidates and everything, and Trump and Rand and Bernie Sanders, interestingly, a couple of my friends support Bernie Sanders, including many of my family members. So I'm surrounded by a lot of socialists, and so it's difficult to talk about these issues with them. I really think that it would actually, in a kind of a weird, twisted way, benefit the United States to have like somebody like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, because it would basically quicken the demise of the United States Empire. Because, you know, in the same way that the Roman Empire collapsed, you know, one of the reasons was due to their vast overreach, their imperialistic overreach, and overextension, as well as the devaluation and debasement of their currency, as is happening right now with all this quantitative easing, 1, 2, and 3. And you know, interest rates like at near zero and soon to be negative territory, completely absurd. Mm-hmm. I think like I'm sure a lot of my libertarian friends would love to have Rand Paul, you know, at the helm of the but unfortunately, if things go sour, which most likely they would under the next president, it's like it seems like to me they're going to blame libertarianism.
Yeah.
Because it happened under his watch, right? And that's kind of
exactly
unfortunate. As if one man really has the power. It's like a train that's out of control. And it's been going like that for decades, maybe a century, and so no one person is gonna turn that around. And it's just like, I think my goal is just to, you know, educate people about what's going on and what is likely to happen, and basically to prepare for that collision. Brace yourself, basically, and get your financial affairs in order as much as you can, get out of debt and things like that. So yeah. That's the way I look at it, the trajectory.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to the question you asked again. This is more of a further clarification. You said, how do we get there?
Mm.
Now, I mentioned how we might get there, but another equally important question is, how do we stay there? Because power tends to centralize over time, and we need to have measures in place that would prevent the centralization of power. See, one of the things that it's not necessarily always the case with voluntarists, but there seems to be a tendency to, correctly, of course, worry about the centralization of state power. But there seems to be a lack of concern for the centralization of private property or corporate power, if it's done through private property systems, right? So if a state were to centralize property, yeah, they'd be upset. But let's say a private individual does, and they could raise a private army. It happened in the past. The Roman Republic, it happened. People would raise private armies because of their huge estates. That's equally dangerous, even though it's technically not a state in the sense of a, you know, government. And of course, the left commits the opposite error. They concern themselves extensively with corporate power, but not at all with state power. So I feel like centralization of power anywhere is suspect and dangerous. And for private property, I would say, and this is one of the most radical, I think the only person I've ever heard advocate something like this, oddly enough, was an anarchist. But what I would advocate to keep property distributed is, in the Bible we have what we call the Sabbath year and the Jubilee year. In the Sabbath year, every 7 years, all debts were forgiven and all debt slaves were freed. So right, in ancient times, you might fall on tough times and have to sell yourself into a specified period of servitude to pay off a debt. It was actually quite common in the early American Republic as well. They were called indentured servants. But every 7 years, they were to be freed. And then every 50 years, any property transaction that took place, the property would revert back to the original owner. Now, those two systems would create, the Sabbath year would hit the reset button on the economy. Debts are canceled, people don't get into debt bondage. And then with the Jubilee year, property reverts back to the original owner. And the way you would enforce Jubilee, I think, is pretty simple. There's a principle in economics called usufruct, where it says that I own the property, the title to the property, but I give you the right to develop it. So let's say, hypothetically, I own a piece of land and you wanted to build, say, near a river, and you wanted to build a water mill on it to generate power for some use, you know, steam turbines or something. So what this system would look like is, you would consult me. I'd say, okay, I think it's a good idea. We'd agree on how much profit I would receive from the use of my land, and then I would give you a certain lease for a certain amount of time, and at the expiration of that time, the land and everything on it would revert back to me. But there'd always be the possibility that, you know, after that reset, we could then renew the contract should it serve our interests. And that's how I think a Jubilee system could be implemented now. Because, of course, the economy is much more complicated than the ancient world. And then the forgiveness of debts, the Jubilee, because this is the one anarchist that I read. I think his name was, I forget his name. But something Graeber. He wrote The 5,000 Years of Debt, a book where he describes the history of debt, and he talks about the problem of debt. And that's another problem that I don't think that libertarians actually deal with. Debt bondage or debt slavery is the proverb says the lender is a slave to the debtor is a slave to the lender. And, you know, that's true. I mean, ideally we all want to stay out of debt. And some people fall into debt through no fault of their own because of, you know, maybe let's say you're a farmer and you buy extra seeds so you can sell them for more profit, but then you have a blizzard that wipes out all your crops. And so now you're screwed. And, you know, those kinds of situations, it's easy to exploit someone in that situation by saying, hey, you know what? We'll loan you the money to, you know, pay the interest on the debt that you already have, but, you know, you're just going to get deeper into debt. And, of course, One of the problems with the debt-based system is that it does allow for the creation of a single unitary property holder, because if everybody gets in debt to him and they just he just, you know, they default on the loans. He just take it all pennies on the dollar. And he owns all the land and created a new state now. It's a danger that's very easily can happen. And it has happened in the past. For instance, Frederick C. Howe was a Republican progressive in the early 20th century. And he wrote a book called The Confessions of a Monopolist, where he describes how monopolies in the United States work and how people get really, really rich. And, of course, with corporate fraud that the state facilitates, what they do is they pump up bubbles and they say, hey, yeah, buy, 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 when it's really going to pop. And then you're left with all this bad debt. They want to get rid of the bad debt. So they fraudulently say, hey, you should buy this. And then when you buy it, they unload the debt on you, and then you're left holding the bag. And other things is, and you don't even need a state to do this. Frederick C. Howe mentions that the railroads, what they would do is give only one newspaper the right to sell newspapers at their stations. So it was a de facto monopoly on the railroads. And so one guy could just, because he was a friend of the railroad tycoon or whatever, could start selling newspapers, and he would be the only one that would do it, because the guy that owned the railroad wasn't like anybody else do it. And one of the ways the railroads would actually get the land from the people to build the railroad is what they would do is they create these bubbles, and they say, invest in it. It's really, really good. And, of course, when the bubble inevitably popped, they would have to sell their land for pennies on the dollar. And classically, throughout most of world history, a kind of debt reset was inevitable. It was actually recognized as a necessity by the cultures that practiced it. I mean, right now, there's no way we're going to be able to pay, the $900 trillion of debt we have since 2007? You know, the global debt after the crisis with the toxic assets?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that can possibly be paid off. It's more than, it's like over 100 times, well, it's almost 100 times more than the U.S. GDP every year.
Yeah. So talking about the monetary system, you know, empires and huge states of the past have often, many times, the reason for their collapse and their failure has been due to corruption of the money supply, right? Because mm-hmm. the money supply is the lifeblood of the economy, right? That's how it runs, mm-hmm. right? You can go back to how money is created, and you know, true money is basically created by by voluntary, people choosing to use a particular item for its qualities that it has, right? You know, it has to be durable, fungible, mm-hmm. Portable,
yeah.
Interchangeable, all this kind of stuff. And then a very good store of value, right? Which oftentimes money does have until they are co-opted and controlled by pharaohs and kings and emperors and dictators that eventually discover ways to devalue,
corrupt the money,
clip the money. Or just print it in vast amounts and distribute it to their friends. So. And then once that happens, just things go awry and prices rise and people blame the business owner, the class warfare and all this kind of stuff is generated. And then you're talking about, the debt now. And of course, any kind of central bank, the Federal Reserve, every single country has, there's really is no country that has a free money right now. It's kind of unfortunate, that we've mm-hmm. come to this situation. But one of the things that I love about voluntarism and anarchy is that, anarchy basically, means no rulers, right? I don't mm-hmm. want a ruler for myself. And I equally don't want a ruler for you or for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And voluntarism is basically just, advocating for voluntary trade between peaceful individuals. Now, any kind of economic system that's voluntarily chosen,
mm-hmm.
sure, you can definitely develop a community of people that have this distributism type of system, which is fine, no problem, as long as it's voluntary. That's the only idea that I'm that I'm against is coercion, you know, using the state, which is why I am an anarchist, right? Using the state, because if an idea is beneficial and useful to the people, why do they need to be forced to fund it, right, through taxation, right? Because if they really wanted it, like, you know, we talk about democracy, like, you know, we are the government and we vote, we have the power, you know, power's with the people. Okay, so if the people really want something to be done, I don't think they need to be forced to do it or forced to fund it, right? If enough people go out there and say, I want this, I think that it can happen. Because people tend to think that government is this kind of superhuman entity that can do things that the individual cannot, right? Whereas what I think what needs to be understood is that the government, you know, is itself composed of human beings, mere mortals, right? Individuals that claim the legal right to do things that individuals would consider a crime, right? Counterfeiting money, right? It's called currency creation or the Mandrake mechanism or quantitative easing, right? Theft is called taxation, right? Or income tax. Spying is called surveillance, you know, kidnapping is called arrest, you know, all these kind of political euphemisms to me that conveniently cloak the fundamental crimes and evils perpetrated by state officials, right? Or even murder, mass murder is called a war on terror or just war itself, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite Voltaire quotes is, you know, it's forbidden to murder unless you do it to the sound of trumpets.
Well, it's interesting is that quote actually comes from the church father Cyprian from the 3rd century.
Really?
That's where the first use of that comes from. And of course, Voltaire was a well-read guy, right? He's a very well-read guy. So, because when I read Voltaire, I said, wait a minute, that sounds very familiar. Where did I hear that before?
Oh, yeah?
So I looked that up, and cool. Yeah, it's, now, this is getting, I think, to some of the moral aspects of this position. So I think the argument is this, that if something is really good for people, you don't need to force them to do it. They would freely choose to do it, right? Is that kind of the gist of the argument?
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Would you agree that there's a possibility where people don't really know what's good for them? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean you can force them to do something, but that, you know, they just don't know what's good for them, and yeah, they should do it, but they're not doing it. I think there's a few examples that I can give where forcing someone to do something that they don't want to do that is in their best interest is justifiable. The first example would be children. Children often don't know what is best for them, and one would hope parents do, and then they would compel their children through various incentives to do that. Another example would be an addict, an alcoholic, a drug addict. I mean, especially if it's a parent or someone, a citizen in the society, maybe someone who runs the Chamber of Commerce or maybe someone who runs a church. These kinds of influential people can't really be allowed to do this. It's going to harm the rest of their obligations. And so people engage in interventions and say, look, stop it. You're just going to go cold turkey. We're going to force you to go cold turkey. Most people, even voluntarists, probably would not object to something like that, even though the person would not consent to it. Another example would be, and this is the one that Walter Block used in his discussion with, let me see, who was the guy that did this podcast? It was Adam Kokesh. It was about spanking. And he said, Walter Block said, well, if someone's going to throw himself off a bridge because they are depressed with their life, you know, as a libertarian, as a person, I'm going to knock them down and say, hey, wait, reevaluate your life. Don't throw it away and jump off the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says, you know, would that be legally sanctionable?
Mm-hmm.
And you actually kind of see that in the movie The Incredibles, when Mr. Incredible saves people and they get hurt in the process, then they sue him.
Right.
So the train is gonna fall off the tracks and they're all going to die.
Right.
So Mr. Incredible stops the train, but of course the momentum is such that it knocks them back and they all break, their necks are all damaged and they start suing him. That's a very libertarian thing to do, right? You're going to sue the guy that saved your life. But I feel like in all those situations, people would agree that, well, yeah, I mean, they didn't consent to it, but they didn't know it was good for them. And a lot of people would say, well, yeah, those are justifiable Unless, you know, there's more information available that would render them unjustifiable. Let's say the child can run out of the street, there's a busy street with traffic. You don't need to consult the child before you pull them out of the street. So, what I'm saying is, having set the precedent that some non-voluntary actions can be legitimate to do for the best interest of other people. Oh, and then one more example, mentally or physically handicapped individuals would not, especially mentally handicapped, would not be able to consent to the caregivers that are hopefully looking out for their best interest. I would argue that if we apply that analogy to the state, do states misuse it? Sure they do. But so do parents, so do caregivers, so do pastors, so do people that run, the chambers of commerce and people that run fraternities. But I also we have to deal with the Pareto's 20-80 rule. Pareto came up with the iron law of oligarchy. Now, the 20-80 principle, you might have heard in context of economics, where 20% of your customers produce 80% of your revenue.
Mm-hmm.
But the other way is 20% of the population is going to rule over the other 80%. And that would be, I think, the way the American founding fathers, even libertarian thinkers like John Locke, would argue is it's the natural aristocracy. People that are the most fitted for these positions are going to rise to those positions. And in virtue of their talent, they're going to have these higher positions of administration. So I would argue that according to the iron law of oligarchy, for which there's almost no exceptions, the 20-80 rule, 20% of the population can rule the other 80%. And the principle that, okay, if we have an obviously corrupt family, the father's an alcoholic, the mother is abusive, maybe a drug addict as well, the children are repeatedly beaten and not taken care of, obviously concerned citizens are going to want to take those children away and make sure they have a better upbringing. But one is not going to conclude from that we should abolish the family.
Yeah.
No. Well, what I'm saying is the argument, this doesn't cover all arguments against the state, but the argument against the state that, well, they don't always look out for our best interest is no reason to advocate its abolition, no more than any other position of authority.